Welcome back, folks. This is NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast, and I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again. Thanks for joining us today. Hope you're all feeling fine and staying safe wherever in the world you might be. We're going to jump right into the conversation today because it's a good one. We've got Shai Greenberg back on the podcast today. Now, to those of you who haven't been with us too long, firstly, you want to listen to the first conversation we've had with him, which is going back over a year now, and we'll link to that episode in the show notes. But just to give you a heads up, Shai is originally from Israel, like myself, spent a good few years in the US, and has been here in Japan for about a decade now. His real estate career started first in an investment banking environment, so mainly debt, equity placement, and loan sales. So he's worked on Wall Street with Cushman and Wakefield, did the round, so to speak. But over the course of his career, he slowly migrated into a more active real estate finance and investment focus, which is what he's doing these days. So not only for work, he's also a senior VP and head of the International Business Division at Genkai Capital Management, but also a professor at Tokyo's Temple University, where he's developed and has been teaching the school's real estate investment curriculum for a good few years. Now, we like to have Shai on the show once in a while because while it's true that most of our listeners, like most of our clients, are smaller scale private investors, what he does and deals with on a daily basis is exactly the macroeconomic trends that then trickle down and affect all aspects of the market, including those segments of it and the smaller deals that we are normally dealing with. So obviously understanding the bigger picture has great bearing on our little corner of it as well. Shai, thank you so much for joining us today. Great to have you on the show again.
Thank you very much for having me again. I'm glad that you listened and found our previous podcast interesting enough for you and beneficial enough for you to call me back.
It was, definitely was. And I think these days, even more, the macro picture is really important these days. I mean, we're going through pretty interesting times, right?
Yeah, extremely interesting time. You know, it's funny, just today I listened to a press conference with Dr. Iwata, who is, you know, his claim to fame, where he came to be well known is when he got off the Corona ship and started talking about how, you know, protection gear for the people giving services is not sufficient enough. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So he's from Kobe University, and he's, if I'm not mistaken, he's an infectious disease specialist. And during the press conference today, somebody asked him, so what do you think the prospects are for 2021 Olympics? And he says, yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that there's any way that's going to happen.
No, what do you mean? It's all good if you listen to the USA and to Japan's government, everything's all right.
It's amazing. No, his explanation was, you know, it's an Olympic is different than let's say a baseball game or football game or a soccer game. It's people coming together from all over the world. So the prerequisite is not only for Japan to get a grip on COVID-19, it's for the entire world to get a grip on COVID-19.
Yeah, and for no second waves and nothing, right?
And he doesn't think that's going to happen next year. Anyway.
Yeah.
Food for thought. It's going to have obviously far-reaching implication on the real estate market in Japan and the entire economy.
I think so. I don't think it's all bad either. Okay, but we're not talking about that today.
Yeah.
So look, first, before we actually touch on how the market is being affected by that right now and last couple of months, we haven't heard from you in a while before that. I think January last year or so. So first, maybe give us a rundown of what 2019 looked like on your end up to that point, up to the outbreak.
Sure. Looks like decades ago. But 2019 was very busy for me personally. We set up a private debt fund to invest outbound, etc. But in terms of larger deals or commercial real estate universe in Japan, it was pretty depressed market in terms of deal volumes. There weren't as many deals as we've seen in years past, and that's maybe partly because of where the cycle was, where, you know, it came to a point where buyers were kind of like reluctant to pay the market prices, which were very, very high. But on the contrary, a lot of mega deals, like historical size deals happened. So not a lot of deals in terms of deal numbers, but a couple of very, very large deals that kept deal volume up for the year.
Okay, so less deals, but pretty big one. Can you give us some examples of those?
Right. So a couple of the more notable deals were Fortress, you know, buying a portfolio of affordable housing units from the Japanese government. We had a REIT, a publicly traded J-REIT by the name of Sakura that was taking over. It was interesting because it's one of the only wholesale takeover that ever happened in the REIT space in Japan. You had a company called Unizo, also a publicly traded company. It also, the ball started rolling via wholesale takeover, which is extremely rare in Japan, but ended up, you know, somebody else ended up buying it in the more of like a friendly employee buyout type of scenario. Then you had SoftBank, finance entity called Oyo, buying a portfolio of service departments, taking over a company called MDI. And then you had the largest transaction ever on record in Japan, single transaction of $2.8 billion of 220 apartment buildings that was bought from Anbank, the Chinese insurance company. It was bought by Blackstone. And so that's it's a very interesting deal because typical to a late cycle deal, that was a portfolio that they sold to them earlier and they bought back from them. So that was an interesting deal.
That was who selling to who?
Blackstone sold this earlier on to the Chinese investor and then bought it back from them.
What was it? A whole portfolio?
It's a portfolio of residential multifamily properties with a big concentration in Tokyo, a little bit in Osaka, and some in other cities, but mostly Tokyo.
Okay.
Yeah. And the other big transaction was a U.S. firm, private equity fund by the name of Fortress. That firm actually was bought by SoftBank also earlier, I think last year.
Yeah,
and then they bought a portfolio of 100,000 affordable apartments from the Japanese government.
Right.
And so effectively, it was a big, you know, headline in the foreign media that Fortress has just become Japan's largest landlord.
Right.
So that was interesting as well. They took a very interesting take on this. It's kind of like actually a good example on how a fresh view of sometimes, you know, somebody who's not Japanese can bring value to something like that, because everybody looked at those, you know, affordable housing, which is not in the best location, not in the best condition, you know, not so close to the station, et cetera, et cetera, and said, you know what, they valued it at a very low price. But these guys came and said, look, we see a potential to putting in foreign blue-collar workers into these apartments. So there was like, it's not really a value-add where you go in and you do a fixer-upper, but it's a value-add where you have a vision that maybe you have a different view on things. That was interesting.
Right, and Fortress and Blackstone, I mean, aside from for Fortress now being owned by Japanese, they're some of the biggest asset managers around, aren't they?
Correct. Yeah, Blackstone is definitely a huge one. Fortress is a little bit smaller, but very good reputation of being, you know, one of the smartest guys on the street.
Okay.
And then you have another transaction by SoftBank via another entity that they invested in called an Indian entity called Oyo, which is like a hotel management company. And they also bought a company called MDI, which, again, does something very similar. They do a lot of like monthly mansion, what it's called, like
yep.
Short-term residential rentals. A very large company that does that. So they bought them. There's a lot of people bidding for that deal, and SoftBank via Oyo got the deal. Then you have, so this is interesting because you see the largest deals last year were all residential. So residential is a very resilient asset class, and in Japan, a well-established one. So a lot of deals are happening around the residential sphere.
Yeah.
And then you have a couple of hostile takeovers, which is, a first in Japan, and not a very rare occasion in Japan because Japanese investors are not, adopted or well accustomed with hostile takeover, and it's not very something that's very common in Japan. But you've seen two of those. The first one is a Unizo, a company called Unizo, which was one of the most aggressive buyers of real estate in the past couple of years. They were bought. It was a big saga, but they're eventually bought by Lone Star. They own a lot of hotels, but they own other properties as well. And then you have Sakura REIT, which was taken over by Star Asia. So all of these transactions started by, the hostile takeover was started and took a lot of twists and turns in the plot, but ended up with in foreign hands. So that's interesting as well.
Okay, so the hostile takeovers are always, in these cases, were initiated by foreign buyers, yeah?
They were actually initiated by Japanese buyers.
Okay.
But at the end of, it's a difficult thing, right? So they were looking for a white knight, and a lot of companies came about, and the bids fell, and other people came, and then it became kind of like everybody knew that this is in play, so it went to the highest bidder at the end of the day. But with Unizo, it was an interesting story because they put in a lot of hurdles on. They wanted to keep their employees on board. That they won't fire any employees, keep their employees benefits, pensions, etc. It was like the hurdle that they put in front of anyone who is going to buy this.
Yeah. So you mentioned Sakura REIT, the real estate investment trust. So, speaking of those, how are the J-REITs doing these days or in the past year? Have they been going up, going down, seeing a lot of action?
So, obviously now with what's happening with the COVID-19, it's kind of like a mess. But over the past year, one of the reasons why deal volume was down was because the J-REITs were not able to participate. J-REITs, when people buy REITs, the biggest draw is to get high, stable dividend yield.
Yep.
So REITs have a very difficult time reducing that dividend yield because they get penalized from investors selling it. If you don't pay me my, what I've subscribed for, I'm going to sell my share, and then it hits their share prices.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was prices went up considerably on the commercial real estate market. That if they were to buy properties at those yields that, were prevalent last year, they wouldn't be able to pay their dividend yields.
Right.
So they were kind of like on the sidelines, which in a typical year, they're the biggest buyers. So that hurt the volumes. But right now they're down considerably. The dividend yield right now for, the entire J-REIT universe is around 5%, up from low threes.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's typically the public market is said to be forward looking. So I guess there's a lot of concern about commercial real estate market in Japan if you're looking just at that, this valuation. Also, another metric that people look at is the price to net asset value. Basically, how much you can buy it compared to how much their properties are worth. So if the times are good and the market thinks property values are going to go up, typically you have to pay more than the current valuation of the property of the REIT. So let's say that the REIT owns 100 million yen worth of properties. To buy the REIT, you would have to pay 120, 102, 103 more than what they actually own.
Because looking forward again.
Because it's looking forward.
Yeah.
And right now, for most REITs, except for logistic REITs, logistic properties, distribution centers, etc. For most REITs, they're trading at below the current valuation of the properties that they own.
So that's interesting. Yeah. So I'm guessing hospitality properties would be leading the downturn there with the
yes.
COVID. Yeah.
Yeah, hospitality and retail are two of the REIT groups that got hit the most. Some of them are trading, you know, at 40% of the current valuation of the properties.
Right.
And again, the current valuation, I don't know who did it when, under what methodology, etc., right?
Yeah. So, I mean, well, that obviously takes us to current events. So not just REITs, hotels, hospitality properties, retails, generally speaking, they've all taken a huge hit, I guess, operationally. But does that immediately tie into their prices as well? Are people looking just forward to the next few months, or are people fairly confident that they might recover at some stage when things go back to normal? What's the lookout there?
So hotels in Japan is the most obvious one because, you know, most of them are, they're not closed, but most of them are operating at a very, very low occupancy rates. Basically, I think most of them are operating at a low. Some of them voluntarily said, you know, it's not worthwhile keeping our gates open with no guests, so we're just closing the hotel for now. So they took a dip. If you are to try to buy one right now and you're looking to, you know, which you typically would get financing from a bank, you'd find it very hard to do because the bank's appraisals, you know, the bank typically gets a third party appraisal report. The appraiser really don't know how to value those right now. What price do you, or what value do you assign to a hotel that is vacant?
Right.
How close will it come back? At what rates? Nobody knows. So that's a challenge right now.
Okay. I mean, we've seen similar things. Obviously, our investors are mostly dealing with residential or small-scale commercial. And we've seen, on that front as well, we've seen prices decrease. I wouldn't say prices decrease, but people are going on fire sales now. Like, everybody was waiting up for the Olympics to boost prices up. Suddenly, lost that little thing at least for a year. And other people who are managing maybe hospitality properties and are now vacant, the smaller scale investors are just not able to keep up with their mortgage payments. Yeah, exactly. Guest houses and so forth. So we've seen a lot of deals at prices that we haven't seen for the last 2 or 3 years. And people are selling at pretty low prices. But do you think, aside from prices, do you think salaries, rents, occupancy rates on the residential front might be affected if the situation continues, even for long-term leases?
So, as a whole, residential is a very resilient asset class. It's difficult to generalize, but you know the right location, I should say, residential is very resilient because urbanization still continues, especially in Tokyo. People are moving in, and in, also in regional cities, people are clustering around the stations. So if you have a property that is well positioned in the market and in a good location, it's a very resilient asset class. Having said that, I think on the very upper end and the very lower end, you might see a little bit of vacancy creeping up because, you know, if you look at what's happening in the U.S., for instance, the jobless claims every month, it's a bloodbath, right? Yeah. With you know millions of new job claims. But in Japan, the market, the job market is such that it's very rigid. It's very difficult to fire people here. You have to go through a very constructed process, and it can be challenging in the court, and it's very difficult to do. So they won't be very quick to fire people. And, you know, obviously, if you fire people, that has a direct influence on the residential market, because if you don't have a job, you can't pay the rent. Having said that, if you look at the way that the job market in Japan is constructed, you have about 28% of the employees which are part-time or contract employees.
Right.
And another 8% which are like self-employed. A lot of them are working, you know, for larger firms as a you know, on assignment basis. But those are the ones that are the easiest one to cut, because they are not protected by those rigid laws and the courts, because, you know, the part-time, that's basically definition of that. So if those guys are going to, and those are typically maybe lower paying jobs. So if you're looking at the lower end, I think you might see, vacancy creeping up. But having said that, I'm pretty bullish on residential in Japan, and even the lower end and the smaller units, because of the demographics, you see more and more, single households with one person.
Yeah.
So you might not need the big, single family home on the outskirts of town. You might be, you're thinking about, 20 square meters apartment. You're typically thinking about a student or, somebody who just joined the workforce. You don't think about, somebody in his silver years, right? In his 80s or in his 70s. But, you see a lot of those type of occupants on smaller apartments nowadays in Japan.
Yeah. And you mentioned low end and high end. Why high end? Is that because executive salaries might take a hit, or what's going to happen there?
High end, is more sensitive to market shifts. And yes, if we're going to see some retrenchment there, then pay cuts, some high-paid expatriates being repatriated back home and stuff like that, you're going to see that market get a hit.
Right. And what about other sectors? Sectors that were gaining until the outbreak. I mean, you mentioned logistics. Data centers, yeah. Offices, what's happening there?
Yeah. So logistics, obviously, we're sitting at home. A lot of the, in my neighborhood, a lot of the shopping malls are closed, the department stores are closed. So if I'm looking to get something, it's very convenient for me to, go online and get it on Amazon or Rakuten or one of those firms. So you see the need for logistics going up.
For shipping and storage, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, this is those huge modern logistics centers are very expensive and very large assets. But this is something that even individual investors can play in, because one of the weakest links in the logistics chain is called what's called the last mile logistics, which is basically your Sagao or Yamato office in your neighborhood, that they get on their bicycles and they deliver these things to your doorfront. So those type of properties are typically not very expensive and not very large, and this is something that even individual investor can participate in. Data centers are very large, again, and expensive type of properties that are more institutional, but you have REITs that you can play in that field. And obviously we're all home and we're all consuming more data, and people saying that going forward this trend might continue, using Zoom, using Teams, whatever, and going on the cloud, having some redundancy, making sure that everybody can work from home. All of that ties into data centers.
Well, Japan's a bit late to the party on that front, but it's been a trend.
Right.
It's been a trend here as well for the last couple of years, at least, right?
Yeah, and I think this thing here is going to accelerate this, because in my firm we've never worked from home, but because we have Office 365, we're able to, right? We have Dropbox and Zoom and Teams and all those great companies. And it's all, basically all the data is hosted in data centers. So I think that will accelerate the trend.
Okay, and how about offices? Does that mean that offices will go down, more vacancies there?
You know, right now, Japan, this is the trend in many cities in Japan, but in Tokyo in particular, the vacancy rate in offices is ridiculous. It's like low, very low single digit, depending on the market you're looking at. It's even like at 1%.
Yeah, Osaka Nagoya too, right?
Which means there's no vacancy, yeah. Right? 1% is there's always a company moving out, moving in. 1% basically means no vacancy. So, and you have a pipeline, obviously, of new offices coming online. But those are in the 80% is already pre-leased. So there's already tenants slated for those properties. So people are not as concerned about the vacancy rates in the office space. There might be some rent negotiation going on to reduce the rent a little bit. So the rent might take a little bit of a hit. But if things come back, then it will go back again. Having said that, you know, if the IMF just came out yesterday and said this is going to be like the great depression in scale. So if that happens, then, you know, a lot of companies go bankrupt, and so who knows, right? That's an apocalyptic scenario.
Right. And how was, obviously, bigger commercial deals take a lot of financing. How was financing affected in the last few months?
So it's funny because Japan had coronavirus fairly early on with, you know, upwards of 30 million Chinese tourists coming into Japan every year. But the countermeasures just started from when we're talking right now, it's like a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
So up until a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, all these were business as usual, including the lenders. Business as usual because, and suddenly, after that, state of emergency was announced, all the lenders started, reconsidering and I shouldn't say reconsider or retrading. They have not, but they've kind of like slowed down the deals a bit. It's like a wait and see approach. We're proceeding with the deal, but let's wait until we get more clarity on where things are landing.
Right.
That's the type of approach, wait and see approach.
From our perspective, again, that's a bit opposing to what you're seeing. One of the biggest changes that we've seen in the smaller investor scale over the last year or so is that, if you recall, last time you were on the show, we're talking about the lack of availability as far as financing is concerned. So at least for non-resident foreigners, smaller private investors, that sort of thing. And that's definitely starting to change both in and out of Japan. So we are now in touch with at least three lenders, one Japanese, one Hong Kong, one Singapore based. And there are at least a few more out there that I'm aware of, mainly for Chinese and Taiwanese residents. And they've all got their own criteria and limitations that they impose on borrowers, but they're out there, which was not the case a year or two ago. I mean, these days, non-residents can actually apply for and qualify for these property investment loans. And that was super rare even just 1 year ago. So again, Corona aside, what do you think brought about this this big shift?
That's interesting. I'm very glad to hear that. Is the Japanese lender a bank or a non-bank?
A subsidiary yeah. of a bank.
Right, right. So I think to a great extent it is directly linked to what we've talked last time. Remember we were talking about the Suruga Bank.
Scandal.
And what came about afterwards were the regulator were looking into a lot of the regional banks. So a lot of the regional banks pulled back. So I'm glad to hear that somebody else came in to fill the void. I think that's what's happening. I think it basically with those guys, I shouldn't say out, but kind of like taking a step back and not as aggressive, it created a void that other lenders came in to fill, which I'm glad they did. So I think that's the thing. There was an article just this week, I think it was in Financial Times, that the regional banks now are going to get pretty severely hit because of this coronavirus, because a lot of them, because of the low interest yield, et cetera, moved into investing in real estate deals and equities and the like overseas.
Getting more adventurous.
A lot of them saw a lot of, you know, big losses. So, you know, they might suffer a little bit from that as well.
Mm. Okay. And just as we start to wrap up, what's on your own personal plate? I mean, Genkai Capital, you're obviously involved, I think, from memory, more in Japanese investment overseas. So what do you think, let's say, the next 12 months might look like for typical, say, Japanese institutional investors?
I think it depends, because there's all these different shades of Japanese investors. Some of them are more aggressive than others. Others are more conservative. I think the conservative ones are probably going to sit on the sideline until there's a lot of clarity. I think the more aggressive ones are kind of like rubbing their hands in pleasure, because they expect some opportunities to kind of like high yield opportunistic type of deal returns will come back to the market. That was like in the last couple of years, at least, it was like a myth, right? Like a unicorn. There's weren't a lot of those in the marketplace, but now I think people can look at the market and find those type of opportunities from distressed sellers, people who really have to sell.
Yeah.
Similar to what you're seeing in the, you know, in your neck of the woods, I think similar thing will happen in the larger properties as well. For cross-border transactions, I think the next couple of months, shouldn't say next couple of months, next couple of weeks are going to be a little bit slow, because at the end of the day, we're dealing with real estate. So it's not like a stock or a bond where you can do your due diligence from your couch or your kitchen table. You actually need to go see, smell, touch, you know, interview property managers, people, competitors, brokers. So
that's not happening.
If you can't travel internationally, then those at least final decisions would have to be put on hold for a while. So
yeah, but after that, you think there's going to be a fair bit of deal hunting? Yeah,
I think people will be definitely looking for interesting opportunities.
Okay, good stuff. Okay, so sounds like you've definitely got your hands full, outbreak or not. Well, thanks again for taking the time to speak with us today. Definitely better
absolutely
for it.
Absolutely, very happy.
Yes, good to have your show again. Thanks for that, Chai. And thanks to our listeners too. Glad you could be with us today, folks. We'll link to Chai's profile in this episode's show notes, so you can get in touch with him directly if you want to. And we're also going to link to our upcoming webinar registration and pre-submission of questions form one last time too. The list of topics for the webinar is probably full enough. You've definitely submitted quite a few topics that you wanted to discuss aside from the syllabus. It looks like we're going to have it on a Sunday evening, Japan time again, which means Sunday morning for our North American participants. But you've still got a week or two to let us know if you prefer other topics or different days and times. So we'll announce the final day and time that most people voted for towards the end of the month. And we hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Do share it with your networks. And as usual, we would really love it if you could rate or review us on the iTunes store. Help us reach more people who can hopefully benefit from this content as well. That's it from us for today. Stay safe, stay at home, and until next time, yoroshiku.